Delighted to be here.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Paul Adler. I teach at the business school at the University of University of Southern California, and my areas of work are in the areas of big complex organizations and how they're organized, and increasingly focused on public policy to deal with the grand challenges of our time.
Wow, indeed, grand challenges is the expression of the day, if not the decade, if not the century. So, Prof. P, I wonder if you could start out by telling us what the things are that are currently concerning you, dynamizing you, preoccupying you, interesting you.
Partly because of the world situation, and partly because of the interest that my students have brought into the classroom, I've found myself increasingly focused on climate change and the climate crisis. So I have to say, the last few years, most of my work and thinking and teaching has been around that theme. And it connects with my socialist politics because it's very hard to see how capitalism responds to a crisis of this urgency and this magnitude. So, trying to keep track of American and European and other countries' efforts to deal with the crisis, trying to understand where tensions and fault lines emerge, challenges to capitalism as a prevailing system can emerge in the context of a fight for a saner climate policy. All that's really been at the center of my thinking and preoccupations.
And indeed, although looking back historically, it's clear that various forms of state socialism, with their rapid industrialization, have had a certain responsibility for the climate crisis. Not that they were to know what they were doing in the teens and the 20s and the 30s and the 40s in the Soviet world. But it's pretty clear, I think, that there is a capitalist element that is absolutely crucial to the problem. In thinking about this, for example, in the context of debate in Britain at the moment about the forthcoming election, forthcoming, as we know, it could be any point really in the next 10 months, but where the Labour Party on the one hand is saying we want to spend 28 million pound billion pounds on a green transition. On the other hand, we can't do it unless we can grow the economy. With absolutely zero sense that there might be a wee contradiction there.
We do need to stop for a second because my door just blew open and I want to make sure we have decent sound quality. Forgive me.
Okay, no problem.
Yes, indeed. That's one of the distinctive features of our capitalist system, that the alternative to growth is just unimaginable, and growth understood as the growth of the commodity producing sector of our society, not growth in the quality of our caring industries and our service occupations. But it's interesting to try to size up the magnitude of the challenge that climate change presents to capitalist societies such as our own. It's been surprisingly difficult for people to get their arms around how is this an incremental problem that'll we should be able to solve with something like 2% of GDP devoted to a redirection? Or is it this some massive transformation that'll engulf a quarter of the economy and dictate our lives for the next 30 years? The economists have for a long time downplayed the magnitude of the challenge we face in the environmental arena, including the ones that within the economics profession have tried to lead the charge in getting economists to think more seriously about it. Bill Nordhaus at Yale, are responsible for terribly underestimating the nature of the risk we face. So it's going to be a really turbulent couple of decades coming up ahead. Pretty hard to see how we don't pretty seriously overshoot the 1.5 degrees Celsius target that the IPCC has set. In the chaos that emerges, when you start getting beyond 2 degrees Celsius, migration, civil wars, resource scarcity, resource wars, not to speak of, devastated agriculture zones and so forth. It does seem like we're headed into a pretty turbulent era, unfortunately. So in the meantime, I'm trying to get some thinking done about, what a path for avoiding that sort of catastrophe would look like. And in that context, it's China. You were referring earlier to the authoritarian socialist experience and how complicit in environmental degradation the old Soviet Union and China have been. But it's pretty an astonishing turnaround that we see in China today, which now has more solar and wind energy than the rest of the world combined. It's, they made a decision a few years back that this was indeed a global crisis and that they would have to get ahead of it. And maybe it's even an opportunity for them to export stuff to the rest of the world. And we get to see something of the power of socialism as a form of coordinated economic kind of activity. When they put their minds to it, all of a sudden, this coordination yields amazing fruit, as it did indeed in raising the living standards of Chinese people. 700 million of them, brought out of the worst forms of poverty in the space of a couple of decades, a mind-boggling transformation. But as viewed from the United States, or I'm guessing from Europe, the mass media portrayals of China are always attempting to convince us that anything worthwhile there happens because of its communist capitalistic features. And nothing, of course, worthwhile could be happening due to their socialistic features. But I think the example that China's posing to us all today is really galvanizing a lot of attention. The progress is super rampant, but the authoritarian features remain just as obnoxious and just as much of a limitation on future development. But I'm very eager to learn more about China as my own work progresses.
I guess it would be fair to say that the insertion of China and India from a reserve army of labor into the international capitalist system was actually crucial to the very rapid industrialization of those countries. But that only tells part of the story because, of course, in the case of India, this followed decades of essentially socialistic investment in creating a cadre of technologists, as they're now called, engineers and so on. And of course, in the case of China, as you rightly say, a transformation from being the workshop of the world at a certain level into being somewhere that doesn't just make things, but imagines things and does so in a very forward-thinking way. So I think there's something very important in what you say. The other element I wanted to ask you about with reference to the environment is the challenge of how one addresses workers and citizens. Because one of my concerns is that when we talk about the green transition in so-called liberal democracies, it seems to me all too often we either speak in terms of a perspective of a consumer, what this will do to your quality of life. This is a big nostrum in the United States, for example. Or alternatively, we say it's bad for blue collar guys who don't have transferable, transportable skills and so on. And I'm wondering about that level of address and how public policy can, getting back to one of your themes, invest in this transformation for workers, for ordinary people in inverted commas, and whether you think there is some way of changing the rhetoric so we're not forever focusing on the so-called wonderful standard of life of consumers.
That's really nicely put. A great way to frame the question. I've spent a fair bit of time over the past year or so thinking about World War II and the economic and social mobilization of the US as a way of thinking about what it would take to orchestrate a Green New Deal, of sufficient urgency and breadth, and with sufficient popular support, because you're not going to do this against the people, right? We're going to have to build some mass support for these transition policies. And I feel a bit awkward mentioning World War II as a platform for imagining what a green transition might look like, because the war is no longer a metaphor. It's a menace, right? Not just for the people in Gaza and Ukraine and other hotspots around the world today, but with the rising belligerence of the US vis-a-vis China. It's hard to avoid the impression that rivalry between the US and China will overwhelm us and overwhelm efforts to drive climate policy.
Yes.
Except insofar as that rivalry can be sort of harnessed by domestic, for domestic purposes to drive a green transition too, right? And that's a bit the kind of national security policy that goes hand in hand with Biden's sort of vision of climate policy. So protectionist vis-a-vis American workers and their interests and American technological leadership, and exclusionary vis-a-vis China, as opposed to sharing and cooperating in these facing these big challenges. So some good things can happen, I think, even in the context of a war-like context that we oppose. So, but it's awkward. As my colleagues working on this paper with me have pointed out, when we began talking about this issue, this parallel, 5 and 10 years ago, when the Green New Deal sponsors, Ocasio-Cortez and the others, explicitly reference World War II as a point of inspiration for the Green New Deal document. War wasn't the reality it feels like today, or the imminence. It doesn't have the imminence it feels it does today. So I do feel awkward about it. Nevertheless, it was a moment in which Americans came together around an existential threat, and ways were found of mobilizing society's resources to fight this threat. There were authoritarian features to that mobilization, to be sure. But there were also some interestingly democratic ones. At a minimum, you have to notice that working people within the US, the ones that didn't get sent off to the front, saw their material standard of living, in fact, improve during the war. Rents were controlled, wages were controlled, prices were controlled. On average, incomes grew during World War II as a function of a very deliberate policy by the federal government to compress income inequality and to institute taxes that would effectively redistribute income to working people. So, different challenge, climate change versus fascism, but a similar, I think, urgency. This has got to happen. That we've got to get our act together in the next 5 years or so, otherwise all hell's going to break loose. And a similar degree of sort of complexity spanning a very broad range of industries that are going to have to be transformed, as well as features of everyday life that will change too. So I do think there's some interesting lessons. One of them, you had encouraged me to bring some of these reflections back to my own scholarship. Most of my research has been studying the way complex organizations work. I've been fascinated by this question for a long time. To be honest, my fascination with big complex capitalist organizations has been motivated by my feeling that that's the biggest, managing large complex organizations is the principal challenge facing socialism, if and where we get to give it a try. And that there might be some things to be learned from the way big complex capitalist corporations function that we could perhaps leverage for insight into the way big complex socialist organizations, much bigger, more complex socialist organizations, like the state, the socialist state, might function as it undertakes this massive planning effort that we'll need to orient ourselves vis-a-vis the climate crisis. So I've been thinking about the US state in World War II as if it were the leadership of a single organization, American society, and sort of analogizing the strategy of the state to the kind of activities that firms do when they're trying to galvanize activity around a strategy at the enterprise level. So first step is you set a direction, set a goal, set a, identify a vision, set some primary objective, right, that represents the fundamental ambitions of the organization. So in World War II, that happened in large measure in response to the catalytic event that was Pearl Harbor. And I do think in some very perverse way, this gives us some hope for relative to climate change. I think it's sort of inevitable that within a few years, we're going to have a either some one major crisis or a concatenation of crisis in a very short period of time that makes very visible the central role of the state as the agency through which society can respond to a major challenge, right? That this is not going to happen through voluntary organizations. It's not going to happen through businesses getting together and pitching in. It's not going to happen. It can't happen except if we mobilize the resources of the state at that more local or the national level. If these are big enough crises, the importance of state level, national level, and indeed international action might become apparent for people. So I have this naive faith that keeps me going as a socialist, that catalytic events of some such kind can have pretty dramatic effects on the political landscape. New ideas become popular very quickly. New political alliances form. New political formations emerge under the pressure of such catalytic events. At least I think that's, we see that in history. Unfortunately, one of the lessons of World War II, if that's the optimistic lesson at that very first step of setting a direction, if the optimistic lesson is there may be a crisis bad enough to actually galvanize our societies into action. The downside is of the sort of negative of the lesson is that depending on the balance of forces at the time that this crisis emerges, right, it may, the outcome will be largely predetermined. The US went into World War II mobilization without a mass mobilization driving political. The political agenda of our country. That we'd been through a massive crisis. There was a tug of war between the business elite and and government, and there were some mass movements, right, with the emerging movement, labor movement, but nowhere near the organized strength of the labor movement to avoid the mobilization of the US during World War II being dominated by corporate interests. And I think the, that one of the lessons of that World War II period is about the urgency of organizing today, a labor movement that sees the climate crisis as one of its top issues, and that's engaged with the environmental movement so as to create some of the kind of organizational infrastructure we're going to need to respond to this catalytic crisis moment, right, to capture the opportunity that it represents rather than letting more reactionary forces, corporate interests seize the day and shape the agenda that emerges out of in that catalytic moment. So I think, I know it's the last time I looked at the AFL-CIO's website, climate change and anything related to it did not figure on the list of, I think it was 18 things we care about most. So that was pretty depressing. It may have changed. I should check again today. But no, obviously, this has been a long-standing problem, the divorce between the environmental movement and the labor movement in the US, as I think in other countries around the world. So, without a bridge to the labor movement, this our efforts will be doomed. And, the responses to the climate crisis will be of a more, corporatist and technocratic kind that might get some elements, might manage some elements of response to the climate crisis, but it's going to leave a lot of pain and suffering in its wake if we leave it up to them.
I wrote a book 3 years ago, Prof. Adler, called A COVID Charter, A Better Future or something, because I thought COVID-19 was that catalytic event. And it has 29 prescriptions for a pacific, wonderful, socialist, feminist post-racial, not post-racial, post-racist future. It's been a huge hit. I think it's been cited 8 times in 3 years. So I feel as though my tentacles are out there. But in all seriousness, I think what's interesting about what you say is the connection you draw between the New Deal in its original form and the war. Because whilst there is a debate amongst economists and economic historians as to the role of the New Deal in combating the Depression, because there were several depressions in the 30s, they kept coming. But no one disagrees that the war was crucial to stimulating the US economy. To me, an interesting connection is that there were two catalytic events. One is the horror of the Great Depression. Unimaginable for many people, really, in the global north, where, my father's father worked in a bank. People didn't lay off tellers. And so my father was the only child at his school who had shoes in the 30s, right? Lower middle class, but unsackable. The horror of that, but then, as you say, Pearl Harbor, so it's the double whammy, the concatenation, to use another term you were deploying, that I think was crucial in all of this. There's another element which came to light very powerfully 60 years after Pearl Harbor, with the horrors of September the 11th, 2001, but then, of course, the horrors of what the US and its lapdogs, like Britain, then did. And this is the legacy of World War II, the terrible legacy of World War II for Britain and the United States, which is we did one thing right, damn it, and that justifies every other thing we do. Every form of idiotic, violent, macho imperialism that these countries engage in, and of course, the United States is the leader, is justified with reference to that. And the Michael Waltz, a fantasy of the just war versus the unjust war. This happens again and again and again in the bourgeois media, in policy debates. The US notion of we are good, and we are good because we beat the Nazis and to a lesser extent Japanese fascism, and we don't even mention Italian fascism normally, right? But it seems to me that there is something there about the concatenation of circumstances, again, borrowing from your language, which I think is absolutely apposite, where COVID-19 did something, but it didn't do enough. And it didn't do enough in terms of a turn to socialism, in part because of the billionaires bankrolling libertarianism as an ideology. And so I'm wondering if you might comment a little bit on that, because it seems to me that the enemy of rationality when it comes to the environment, is these hundreds of think tanks right across the global north peddling lies.
Yes, there's been a lot of terrific work done to kind of trace the evolution of the fossil fuel industry's strategies and its allies over the years. What I think the in the standard analysis that we go from denial to distraction to delay, and we're into the kind of serious delaying business right now. As we saw at the last COP conference, kind of negotiating new oil deals as we're negotiating our retreat from fossil fuels.
I shouldn't
Sensible.
laugh, but if you don't laugh, all you do is cry, right?
So you're asking question, your question, I think, takes us to the question about where does a social movement emerge, capable of bringing together these actors and these voices. Most of my, I think about that problem from two angles. As a, in my research, I take a little part of it, and then as a concerned citizen, there's the bigger part of it. The bigger part of it, that I don't get to address in my own research is, in my mind, got to do with the sort of disintegration of established progressive forces in Western capital societies, unions progressively losing traction, with the exception of a couple of countries where the law is sufficiently protective of them, largely as a function of the onslaught of neoliberal sort of labor market re deregulation, but also because of the mutation of industries towards from manufacturing towards service sectors, and the difficulties unions have had in sort of establishing themselves in new industries and new social categories. But also, I think a lot of the strength of the left, anchored as it was in workers' movements around in the capitalist world, had to do with traditional forms of kinship and community. Unions weren't organizations where you met your fellow members at work for the first time. These were people who'd come from that you knew from the street that you played on as a kid, and they were part of your extended family or the neighborhood. And so there was a dense set of social ties there that gave solidarity, union solidarity, a very personal meaning for people. And as those communities are being geographically disrupted, occupationally disrupted, educational sort of has torn them apart, for better and for worse, opening up people to new opportunities in this more cosmopolitan world that they're now sort of forced into. But finding a way, finding, I think those have all worked to undermine the traditional forces of solidarity on the left that gave impetus, energy, to progressive organizing. And rebuilding them, I think, is going to, hopefully, it can happen through more in an accelerated way through some catalytic event. But it might be a longer process. Unions weren't built in a day, even where people did live and work in much greater proximity. That was long, arduous efforts, not and arduous and difficult, not just because the bosses were opposed and they sent in their thugs, but also because it's a new way of thinking about yourself in the world, as part of a collective and not just an individual that's got a home mortgage they have to pay off and kids whose dental care they can't afford. I think rebuilding a progressive movement capable of sort of bringing this broader socialist vision into focus. Boy, we are a long way. I'm not seeing it. And because it's not just a matter of sentiments, I think what is true is that we all feel that at any the catalytic events, whether it was 2008, Occupy, COVID, these things can bring people together rapidly around a shared passion, but it's not organized. And without durable organization, we don't have a movement. To on which we can build. And so that's the part that's missing for me. Social movements these days we sort of interpret as flurries of interest on TikTok, but that's not a social movement. That's maybe one manifestation of the surface manifestation of the existence of something you'd want to call a social movement. But an organized social movement capable of driving social change, that's a whole different thing. And I think this is just a hard road of rebuilding ahead on some new foundations, but it's not yet emerged to me in the reading I've done what those new foundations will look like. And to bring it back to climate crisis, it's not clear, what that all that's going to look like happening under these crisis conditions that are going to engulf us, over the coming decade.
Prof. Adler, I want to go back 3 decades to your work, because you mentioned that your research has some connection to the environmental crisis, but you edited one book and co-edited another in the early 90s in those heady post-socialist or post-state socialist days when there was meant to be a peace dividend. And these books were about technology and the prospect of, or the reality of, the transformation of work and organization through technology. And in one case, I mean, one of the books is called Usability, and that was conceived of as some kind of panorama of the future, a desideratum. I wonder if you can remember back to those days. Take us back to what you were up to and how you view it from the vantage point of today.
Oh boy. So a lot of the concern back in the 1980s on the progressive left was about the likely de-skilling effects of this wave of automation, computer-based automation that was then sort of making its way across manufacturing and services. In the research I had done on the computerization of banking and then in some other sectors as well, I came away convinced that even under capitalist conditions, where driven by profit motives, technological change usually, more often than not, I should say, led to an increase rather than reduction in skill requirements of people's jobs. Just this kind of interesting fact of the evolution of technology and work. It's certainly not universal. There are cases where technologies, and certainly technologies have killed jobs altogether, right? But if we compare the quality and the skill mix of jobs before and after, these big waves of automation, typically you'll find an increase in the average skill requirements. Some people argued for a long time that there was a polarization of skills. There'd be an elite at one end, but a mass of de-skilled workers at the other. And I didn't find much evidence for that either. And so, if that's under capitalist conditions, the net result of technological change in this skills dimension, then it opens up some interesting opportunities for public policy, right? Training workers, developing skill development paths and career paths for workers, that all makes a lot more sense than if you feel that all of these efforts are somehow working at cross purposes with what managers are trying to do with these new technology implementations. So it seemed like there were some things worth doing there. And then usability enters the picture because, whether these new technologies have this upgrading or de-skilling effect has a lot to do with how they're implemented, not just their intrinsic features. And so for any given technological potential, sort of how do you design the embodiment of that principle as a piece of equipment that somebody's going to use? How to manage to actually use it in practice. The same hammer can be used as a weapon or a tool, right? The same computer can be used to, and software can be used to expand people's range of work activities or to narrow it, et cetera. So this all seemed like interesting stuff. And then, looking at how folks actually went about designing those tools and the interfaces that people had with the equipment they were working with seemed worthwhile. I think the fair thing to say is that we face some of the same issues today with AI. Many of the debates we currently have about AI will destroy jobs, create jobs, have a de-skilling or a polarizing effect on skill requirements. All of that stuff is still exactly being replayed today without, for the main part, quite oblivious to the work that's been done on these same issues, by many generations earlier, mine just being one of quite a few who've studied this issue over the last century and more. But in some ways, a little different too. Certainly, my own thinking on these issues back at the time I was doing those two books you mentioned, back in the mid-80s. I was much more optimistic about the future development trajectory of the United States It was clear that we were going through some period of crisis, but it seemed really hard for me to imagine that the period of US hegemony in the world was coming to an end when it had been so short. And now I'm much less convinced. Arigi and others have convinced me that it may be over for the US as a global international hegemonic power, given the rise of China. And it's not clear that the US ruling class and its state system has the capacity to orchestrate a kind of a proactive, progressive response to the challenges and opportunities it faces, the climate change challenge, the digital transformation opportunity. You could imagine a very sort of proactive sort of embrace of these challenges on the part of a self-confident American capitalism. But that's not what we see. We see an American capitalism seriously doubting its own capacity to master these challenges, and essentially kind of a little, there's a bit of a kind of a desperation quality to policy thinking I find in the US today. Really? We have to ban technologies from reaching China? Oh, and then the next headline a week later is they're a year behind us in AI. Oh, a whole year, really? It's like there's desperation in the air, and it shapes the kind of industrial policy we can imagine coming out of Washington, and it gives it a lot of this defensive flavor without really offering people, as you were going back to a point you were making earlier on, without offering people an inspiring vision of where we're headed
We're
with the
headed.
transformation in the
Well,
world.
Prof, I'm drawn back to yesterday or the day before. We're talking in mid-March 2024, and an inkling of the two decadent empires on the same day, just about, that Congress decides that TikTok must be taken over by US capital or it will be banned. The British government announces that the Tory graph, the Daily Telegraph, the organ of the ruling class idiocy of the United Kingdom, must not be owned by the state of Qatar via a shell company formed by a disgraced president of CNN is absolutely hysterical, flailing around in these pathetic ways. But one of the things that's often leveled at Marxism is that is its alleged failure to understand microeconomics, to provide a theory of the firm. That it may have got things right in many ways at the macro level, but not at the firm level. And this is the great, the big man shaking his head. This is, something that is absent by contrast with a neoclassical model. A decade and a half after you produced those two edited books we've been talking about, you know where this is headed. You co-edited a book that was looking at the firm as a collaborative community. And whilst I should say that I think this alleged absence of a theory of the firm is bullshit, I mean, Engels ran a goddamn factory thanks to daddy's money, and Marx, apart from anything else, was a great ethnographer. But whatever else, I wanted to think about this issue of the firm in your thinking, in your work, in the context of this alleged aporia.
I think there's lots of elements of Marx's own work that shed light on the workings of the innards of capitalist firms, and but I do think the way they've been pulled together by my fellow Marxist thinkers has been missing a beat. Going back to those comments I was making about de-skilling, I think the way most Marxist theory has understood the organization of the capitalist enterprise, the assumption has been that work organization reflects the profit imperative, driving down costs of labor as of materials and other costs. And that De-skilling seems almost intuitively obvious as a kind of prediction, if you beginning with that understanding of the nature of work within a capitalist enterprise. As I see it, the capitalist enterprise doesn't have just one objective, profit. It has two contradict objectives that exist in some complex contradiction, namely to generate that profit, they have to produce something of value to somebody. Of use value. And that tension between use value and profit or exchange value runs through the firm. Managers within that firm have to maintain their dominance over workers, ensure discipline, fire workers who are recalcitrant or not showing up. They also have to orchestrate a complex division of labor, animate, a complex collective of workers. And managers play, Marx tells us, this dual role of symphony conductor and exploiter at the same time. And so for me, a constant source of fascination in my own research has been the evolving forms of work organization, evolving as they do, those two roles, orchestrator and exploiter. They're not just static, kind of, it's not some frontier of control that moves back and forth across the battlefield. This is an evolving organizational, and new forms of collaboration emerge over time. New forms of exploitation emerge over time, within the firm as more broadly in society, and the dialectic of the two, I think, is, you'll forgive this very old-fashioned form of Marxism, is driven by the cumulative development of the forces of production, representing the use value pole of that contradiction that enter into contradiction with the maintenance of the capitalist relations of production represented by the exchange value pole. So it is technological change that forces these systems to evolve, along with the class struggle that is its manifestation. So I keep on trying to keep alive in the Marxist discussions, that very old-fashioned version of Marxism where the fundamental contradiction isn't the contradictory sort of the tension between the classes and class struggle, but between the forces of production and relations of production. So it's a pretty old-fashioned reading of Marx. I think it's the most straightforward one. It's the one that also gives us the most direct apprehension of what really goes on in organizations where every day, if you work in a complex organization, you see that tension between, people want to organize to get stuff done, and but then there's stuff that happens that is just driven by market dynamics and, somebody's idea about how to squeeze a bit more juice out of these workers. Those two things sometimes reinforce each other. It's the boss's need for higher quality products, speedier deliveries that has them catalyze a discussion amongst workers about how better to organize their activity. But sometimes those same pressures undermine that collectivity and its effectiveness as a collective worker. So I think that tension is very real in firms, and that it's something about the nature of the cumulative development of the force of production that in turn explain why over time we see this drift upwards in the skill profile of workers. Marx predicts it in first volume of Capital. Capital needs workers that are capable of more flexibility and engaging with different kinds of machines in a more flexible manner. They develop educational programs in order to build those capabilities in the working class. So I think that process still continues. It doesn't continue with much state support in the United States today for the reasons we were talking about earlier on, right? But it's still progressing. And so I keep on trying to trace the evolution of forms of work organization under those two pressures, in particular vis-a-vis this digital transformation and the wave of transformation of work organization we see associated with that. And now with this AI kind of extension of that digital transformation, it'll be interesting to see where it takes us.
And Prof, the last book of yours that I've read, that I'm up to date with, is one that does have some hope attached to it. The 99% economy. And this is a great argument for socialism. It's a wonderful book. I wonder if you could share with us some of the spine of the 99% economy. What is
Okay.
it as a concept, and what is the more positive future that you can see emerging from what one hopes will be the ruins of capitalism, but not the ruins of humans? other animals.
Right. Well, thank you for your kind words about the book. What's the best way to frame this? In that book, I took the environmental crisis as one of just six crises that seemed to speak to some pretty fundamental limits to the capitalist form of social organization. Recurrent crises, alienation at work, and so forth. No need to rehearse them all here. I made a fairly straightforward, what I think is a fairly straightforward argument that as to why these crises are not just attendant to a particular form of capitalism, but reflect some very fundamental features of capitalism. It couldn't be, so they couldn't be resolved without moving to some fundamentally socialist form of society where people decided democratically together how to use society's resources rather than letting those decisions be made by the market. So,
Right.
program anti-coordination rather than ex post coordination by this clumsy market mechanism. And what I tried to do, the novelty of the book was arguing that this vision of a socialist sort of planned economy, a strategically managed economy, I called it in the book, runs into some fairly common counter arguments or concerns, in particular relative to democracy. How do you engage? How could you imagine a planning process at that scale and complexity proceeding democratically? People worry about a system in which everything was planned. Where would innovation come from? They worry about a system. They say, well, hold on a second. This is going to be, this huge government bureaucracy is running everything. We know something about bureaucracies and their inefficiency. So where would, what sort of efficiency could we ever hope to get in a society like that? And then the fourth kind of concern seems to revolve around motivation and, why the hell would anybody work particularly hard in a system in which everything was guaranteed to them the way you socialists promise it? And so the novelty of the book lay in calling out those four challenges and pointing to the way big capitalist corporations have attempted to deal with exactly those four challenges within their own strategic planning processes. And as I said before, I think capitalist forms of work organization evolve over time, and this tension between collaboration and exploitation isn't the static one, but evolves over time. And I've been interested in the more advanced forms of collaboration we see in some of the bigger, more sophisticated firms that engage this strategic management process for very large ensembles of workers, tens of hundreds of thousands of workers, and have also encountered these same challenges that socialist planning is facing. They need democratic input because they need new ideas from the bottom up of the organization. They need innovation, that's obvious. They need the efficiency. They have big organizations that set standards, but they can't let those standards kind of rigidify innovation capacity. They can't let those standards burden people with paperwork that kills any efficiency, and they can't let all of this organization suck the motivating kind of intrinsic interest of people's work. And so big capitalist corporations have struggled with these issues, not very well, right? Because they're capitalist corporations. But on a good day, it seemed to me we can see some pretty interesting solutions that they've come up with, and that we could indeed generalize to socialist planning. And so in the latter half part of the book, I tried to explain, how the kinds of principles that emerged in that context could infuse socialist planning. With respect to standardization and the idea that in a socialist economic system, you'd have much more limited range of goods and services, everything would be standardized. I think that's one of the pathways to a degrowth program, right? Let's say we don't we really do we really need 100,000 models of shoes or t-shirts or let alone automobiles or buses. We could if we could standardize on a few of them, we would save enormously in social resources devoted to that production activity. And that standardization could be done in a very empowering way. It doesn't have to be imposed by some bureaucrat from above. Standardization in big capitalist firms often happens in a bottom-up way, where people are invited to come up with the best they know how to do to get their job done and write it down, and that becomes the standard, the best practice standard. And so I think just taking one of those elements with respect to efficiency, standardization represents an enormous opportunity for socialism, and you could easily imagine it scaled up to encompass whole industries, and dramatically improving both environmental performance as well as economic outcomes. And then with respect to the idea that that we're looking for, we need that bottom-up input into the goal determination process and in the strategizing process. It's pretty interesting to see the way some of these capitalist organizations have tried to orchestrate real dialogue about what their rank and file members see as opportunities and threats in their business, and try to synthesize what they have to say in some meaningful set of goals. Yes, the senior leaders of these capitalist corporations have to counterbalance these wonderful ideas coming at them from their rank and file with what they see as the imperatives of their investors, to be sure. But that doesn't mean they haven't organized some pretty clever ways of organizing that bottom-up input internally. And I find that inspiring, because we tend to look at the sort of processes for ensuring participation in those strategizing processes as a pretty boring rigmarole, a kind of a ritual of corporate planning. There's a lot of management literature telling you that strategic planning is a waste of time, that it's just people ritualistically presenting PowerPoint presentation decks. But no, when it's done well, take the example of participatory budgeting. Participatory budget has been a phenomenal tool for activating community engagement when it's been really well done. Well, there's a lot of similarities between some of those techniques and the ones we see in corporations. So what I tried to do in the second half of the book was just identify these four big challenges and show that these were challenges that capitalist firms had already shown us how we could overcome them, even if, as capitalist firms, they were themselves not very well at implementing those solutions to those challenges. So yes, that was a fun project, I think. I have to confess, like your book on COVID, I'm not sure mine had the distribution that I'd been hoping for, mainly because it's such a nutty idea that socialists should go learning from corporate planning in big capitalist corporations about how better to conduct socialist planning. But I thought it was also an argument for a lot of people who don't necessarily think of themselves as lefties, who are in the corporate world. It turns out most people work for corporations. They don't work for little startups or as independent journalists. Most people work for big corporations. Most people have experience of bigger organizations in their formal structuring process. And I thought if you could make the idea of socialism meaningful to people by showing the analogy between socialist planning and when capitalist planning works well on a good day, then maybe we would sort of bring around some people who could say, "Oh yeah, I could imagine that might work." And that was what I was hoping to achieve in that book.
Our day will come.
You're singing my song.
So, Prof. Paul, I've got two more questions, after which I'd like to hand it over to you to add anything you may wish to what we've said. My first one involves holding up this little gizmo. It's a telephone, it's a smartphone, and it wouldn't exist without the Pentagon mostly giving over hundreds of millions of bucks to research universities and then handing over the results to lazy, ignorant, indolent, stupid capitalists like Steve Jobs, who never come up with an idea in their lives. So the point of this childish provocation, courtesy of Mariana Mazzucato, of course, is this: there's a huge bureaucracy in the United States, the biggest bureaucracy the world's ever seen. It's called the US military. It is given a free pass by everybody in the country as A, not genocidal, B, not the state, C, efficient, D, glorious. We have a working example of a propaganda symbol of socialism that is massively powerful in the United States, and that is really committed to innovation, viz the phone, and B is really committed to dealing with climate change. This gets back to your World War II turning point. Given the ambivalence we must feel about militarism, how about the military as the place to infiltrate?
Well, there's always good reasons to have some comrades working in the military. I think there's many things about the way the US military operates that would be worth emulating in a socialist society. Obviously, not the goals and policies, the goals and objectives they pursue. But there's a lot of smart people in the US military who work hard to create an organization that's effective. There's also a lot of careerists and people who are just in it for themselves, obviously, like any organization. But some of the organizational innovations have been pretty interesting and thoughtful. And indeed, intensely aware of the security threats represented by climate change, perhaps not as aware of the enormous environmental footprint of their own operations there, but I'm not sure where I see the military fitting in here. I see national security concerns driving Biden's industrial policy and climate policy and the intersection with climate policy. I see the military re reacting to climate change concerns as regards, the physical security of their bases and so forth. I've not read anything yet about greening the US military, have you? I'm guessing maybe somebody in there is working on a plan to zero emissions military by 2050. God help.
They're beating off P on talking about the climate challenge. There will be people in little offices beavering away on this, as you suggest, but they're not prepared to say that one of the reasons why planes are delayed across the world, one of the reasons why fuel is wasted for no good explanation, is that the Chinese and US military are occupying air lanes all the damn time. And
Yes.
there are people trying to estimate the impact of this, as you say. But it's speculation, pretty much. Okay, last question for you before I invite you to add or indeed subtract from what we've said, and it's this. You're in a school run by someone who was my roommate in college that is dedicated, as far as I can see, to reproducing the capitalist class. This is not a criticism of you by any means. As I say, I'm suggesting infiltration of the US military as a path to 21st century socialism. But it's to ask you about critical management studies, which has been inordinately important in some contexts, but looks as though it's on the retreat to me as an inexpert outsider. Could you tell us what it is and how it's doing?
So, a few different things come together. You have the rise of business education. Most of the people looking for business degrees are not doing it because they're ideologically married to capitalism. They're doing it to pay the rent. And some of them come in. Some of them come into business schools with quite critical perspectives on the system in which they live. But, they figure, got to. This is at least the way I can live and support my family. Factor number two, a lot of academics teach in business schools, not because they believe in the capitalist ethos of business, but because they also need to pay the rent. And they're intrigued, by the phenomenon of business. And business schools being located in universities, they inherit something of the ethos of academic independence. So add a third factor, which was the when Thatcher went to war against sociology programs in the UK, many of those folks, at the time, Marxism being quite influential, many of those folks migrated to business schools and brought their Marxism with them. So from there, we moved from a period where sort of Marxist ideas are quite common in the UK, somewhat in Europe, in continental Europe, but where business schools haven't quite established as much of a presence as they have in the UK and the US. And then in the US, no migration from sociology, but a gradual infiltration from people from psychology, sociology into the business school world. Against, whereas in that early period in the 1980s, Marxism was pretty dominant. So post-Marxist ideas become more dominant, and the confrontation between the two in this little teapot of academia intensifies. But we do end up seeing more critically oriented scholars st interested in management issues, increasingly, playing prominent roles as, both writing in the management field journals, active in scholarly associations in the UK and the US, and eventually sort of networks form, and we create sort of a couple of different overlapping networks of, around the idea of critical management studies. A little inspired by the same vein, critical legal studies, critical literary studies. We use critical in the, as I was involved in getting the US network together, we use critical in both of the more traditional senses, and the more post sort of Marxist senses. And move forward with that ambiguity, or that mix, I should say, of perspectives, sort of a hodgepodge of ideas running from kind of liberal critiques, to of the oppressive character of alienating capitalist corporations, to Marxism, post-structuralism, and strands of various kinds. It's become quite established, especially in the UK. Many of departments are essentially dominated by a critical management studies ethos. It's a lot of it ended up in management education, in so there's a specialized field of sort of management education within the sort of management scholarship. There's people who specialize in how to teach management to potential managers. And so in that context, too, these critical ideas have a lot of traction for people. Our job is to educate managers to have a critical point of view on the world. And so it's natural that we bring those ideas into those discussions. So yes, there's a pretty active community. Many of, I should say, the more mainstream elements of the management scholarship field are also open to critical ideas. They're working business schools to pay the rent, not to buy obeisance to the ideology. And then the pressure on us as academics, to pay obeisance to the profit motive is pretty limited. I'm guessing there's limits to our activism. But as long as it's presented in a sufficiently obscure and scholarly way, no one really cares. So no, I think some good work is being done, both in work that sort of calls itself out explicitly as critical management studies, as well as in the work that doesn't, that works with quite conventional concepts. Many of those concepts are plenty powerful enough to launch a savage critique of many features of capitalist oppression and exploitation. So, as I say, fueled by the ambivalence of students, and including young doctoral students who come in, sometimes with very progressive values, and then the academic freedom we enjoy, I think there is a pretty lively literature that brings a sort of critical lenses of various kinds to bear on management scholarship, even in business schools. And my dean, bless his heart, has been very supportive of me. I published an op-ed piece recently on why business schools need to employ more socialists. He was very supportive, thought this was great.
Well, as I say, he had to put up with one in the apartment in the 1970s. So, Prof. Paul, we started out, I think, quite depressively, and we've become a bit more optimistic over the last hour. Maybe you want to give one last message of hell or hope.
Yeah, it does seem like it comes down to socialism or barbarism, doesn't it? I come back to the Chinese example because it's somewhere between socialism and barbarism. but it's I'm hoping we can orchestrate some scholarly and, for that matter, political dialogue between US and perhaps British, European scholars on the one hand and Chinese scholars on the other, too. I think building bridges between scholars in the different regions, we can do what we can to counter this increasingly belligerent sort of atmosphere. And we have so much to learn from each other. The Chinese government and Communist Party understand the need to listen to the people. How far they're willing to respond to that need, that's complicated. But it's not like they're oblivious, to the needs to the demand for democracy. And by, we've got some things to learn from them about the way they deal with that. And we sure as hell have some things to learn about, what we call in our academic lingo policy coordination, how to ensure that actually people across the various sectors of our economy and society are working towards shared goals. So I do hope that that Chinese collaboration might strengthen in the coming years.
Well, thank you very much, Paul. I've been lucky enough to meet you a couple of years ago, and I didn't realize when we met how much of your work I'd read, funnily enough. But since then, I've had the opportunity to read much more of it, and it's been enormously instructive and hopeful. And I feel the same way about our conversation today. I'm profoundly grateful to you.
Well, thank you, Toby. It's been just a delight talking with you, and look forward to talking again sometime.